SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
From Tucson, the University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program Symposium on Racing. A very good morning. Wednesday, Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website too, stevebick.com. Good morning, Hammer.
Good morning, Steve. Not too bad for the third morning.
No. Bright, and you had it. Yeah, it's gorgeous. A beautiful. You could tell 45 minutes ago it was going to be an amazing sunrise.
I mean, this is what you get in the desert after maybe a day or two of light sprinkles and rain. The clouds, it's a pink-orangish combination off to the east, and it's going to be one of those glorious days. Crisp and cold right now, probably in the 40s, but it'll get up to the high 60s and typical desert life in December. And that's what makes Tucson very appealing, especially for a conference when you talk to people that are coming from places where it's snowing. And
single degrees, and single digit numbers back east. And absolutely.
This thing in Chicago right now, this convention, I don't think would work too well. That's why Tucson's the perfect time of year and the perfect location, because most people show up with a smile.
Well, and the first full day of activity yesterday, and we really, I thought, set the perfect tone with Dr. Durenberger, because she, in turn, set the tone on the majority of the discussions yesterday, specifically her social license to operate concept, and then a lot of the safety habit and practice, and the other topics, like the one that I moderated on surfaces. I want to talk a little bit about what went on there, both on the dirt side and the synthetic side. Today, a little bit more of a wider array of discussions, and we'll get a series of students to circle through. We always do on Wednesday. We always have a few of the students, and there's a couple of alumni on hand already, and a couple of alumni that are on their way here.
Yes, and you know, we sometimes forget, and I get reminded as the people show up, that it is about the students, and they proudly showed some of their projects that they did yesterday.
Yep.
And they put a lot of work into it, so we'll get to talk to them a little bit. And I interestingly enough, I walked in on a few of the speakers yesterday, and the one that caught my attention most that I wanted to make sure I saw was the one that on the press, basically how to talk to the press by
Gregory Peck.
Gregory Peck,
not Atticus Finch, Gregory Peck, but
yes, and so it was very fascinating. Unfortunately, I was in the room and it was about half full at that time. You know, I looked around. I didn't see any track operators in there. I didn't see any of the people that I was hoping would be in there, because he was gave some very valuable information on how to
confront,
not necessarily confront, but how to do an interview. Even getting down to posture and, you know, facing the person that's interviewing you, look them in the eye, and what to talk about and how to say things. And, and he was focusing on some of the issues that we've run into lately, basically horse safety, and, you know, state your case, support it, illustrate it, and then restate it. Those are his four messages of how to get a point across. And I thought that was, you know, I mean, you're in the media. I am a semi-media person. And, talk to the press on many occasions throughout our lives. And all you can do is say the wrong thing. I mean, a good no comment sometimes is the best thing you can say if you don't have anything constructive to say. And it was very fascinating. And he went through a couple of drills. You could see if you took one of his daily seminars, how much deeper he would get into that. He brought a few people up from the audience and interviewed them and critiqued how they answered the questions. And it was very fascinating. And, I took a few things away from that because inevitably we end up having to talk to the media, and if it's a good, most you can make it a good experience and not a bad experience.
Well, and the biggest challenge on that front, and we brought it up already the last couple of days to some degree on a tangent, but invariably when there is the opportunity, it's been forced on. You mentioned the track operator, but it's invariably responding to a difficult scenario, and that's the. I hate to constantly use the crisis management moniker, but that's the key time to have the right responses, and often the only response you can come up with because there's so much research or so much investigation that has to go into how things occurred. You almost can never give a satisfactory. The industry can almost never give an immediate satisfactory answer. It's invariably whatever response we come up with, even if it's a neutral one acknowledging a circumstance, it's criticized to the nth degree because the prudent response is, We'll figure out what transpired and how to do our best to prevent it from happening again, and that's invariably the scenario that we deal with in this arena.
Absolutely, and that's why I thought that was so important. And part of the major problem is getting the word out. I think not being able to handle the media earlier in the situation in California made it even worse. And it's important to put the right message across, but also important to have the right person representing you to the media, and that was brought up too. It was a good little workshop that I enjoyed. We got a little book here, Meet the Press with Success, with a few little tidbits in there, and I actually talked to Mr. Peck afterwards a little bit and asked him about it. But I'm fascinated we're talking to the masses right now, and I critique when I watch the news how people are interviewed and what they say and how they say it. And as far as I'm concerned, if you can learn a little bit along the way, it is basically more informative to you and makes you sound a little bit better.
Well, and it should be a response that inspires confidence from the public and ideally, from within the industry and stakeholders and everybody that that has an interest in the game.
I think what we forget, they're not going away. The media is not going away.
No.
I was taught that early on by Bob Umfrey, and I noticed how he dealt with the media and joked around with them and kind of did things his way. And he told me he said they were not going to go away. So you might as well get along with them. And I've used that, and I have a lot of friends now that are in media, and not that they do favors for you, but you exchange information back and forth and become sort of friendly with them. And as human nature will have it, they maybe go a little bit lighter than they could if they didn't know you better. I've just seen that along the way, and they have a job to do, and we talk about this with the kids. I brought up some media situations where I've told them, when you get in a situation, when you talk to media, you tell your story, they write it. If they write something that you didn't really want to get across, well, that's your fault because you didn't get your story across. And I know that's happened to me sometimes when I think I'm telling them, yes, we're going to paint the wall blue, and they say the story, we're painting it red, and it's like, it's my fault. I didn't get my story across to this guy. So be very careful when you talk to them and when you're off the record, tell them they're off the record and they will respond to that. But you know, just be careful, learn how to deal with the media, and you can use them to your advantage as well.
As a sidebar, and to take a, I suppose, a ripped from today's headline story from yesterday that was coming to light and hitting you know, media outlets as we were, you know, basically the last half hour, the last 40 minutes of the show, the statement that Peter Miller, and I'm imagining that most of you listening got wind of this yesterday. It's probably 21 hours old at this point. But a rift between Gary Hartounian and David Burnson, the owners of Stormy Liberal. And my assumption is that they were 50-50 partners in Stormy Liberal. Otherwise, one or the other would have had control before this circumstance arose. But the Hartounian selling out to Burnson, who wants to go on with Stormy Liberal. Peter Miller with a statement saying that it's his opinion that Stormy Liberal, and he would have been his desire that Stormy Liberal retire. And in this environment, it's obvious what Peter, and then later from Hartounian, sort of, he didn't modify per se Peter Miller's statement. But he did add some further context, and I hope for people confidence about what is transpiring here. And Stormy Liberal was sent to Ocala to Dave Scanlon. And for those of you who don't know who Dave Scanlon is, the horse is in very good shape and very good hands for David Scanlon and whoever the vet team is going to be that's going to look him over and observe him, and if Scanlon's going to work with him here to see if he is going to continue to race. Dave Scanlon is as capable as any horseman that a horse could be sent to. And you could have a lot of confidence that Scanlon will take good care and make the right decisions about how to handle the horse from here with input from the vets. But it does set up a very difficult scenario. And Peter, obviously, you know Peter a long time. He's trying to send a message out there. And it's a not awkward situation, but it puts everybody in a sort of a precarious situation.
Well, let me just tell you, Peter Miller spent a lot of time with Stormy Liberal, knows him better than anyone, got a lot of joy out of him and Rockingham Ranch and David as well. And when a trainer's with a horse that long and knows him that well, and he decides to say, "Hey, you know what? I think it's time to end the racing career." I don't know. Like you said, it's going to put everyone in a very nervous, precarious situation if this horse does make another appearance on the racetrack.
Now, I reached out to Peter too, and to see if he wants. I'm sure his statement speaks for itself. I thought Hartounian's portion of it helped modify what the situation would be, and where things were going to go from here. And so we'll watch how things proceed.
You know, you told me about you. Being here, sometimes you're in where everybody is, so I don't have time to reach out and see what's going on in the real world. You showed me that story yesterday. I was very surprised by it, Peter. Peter does a good job with his horses. He takes care of them. He's got great help. And for him to recommend the horse be retired and basically be overruled is interesting. So anyway, today we head into the last part of the seminar, the last day, as you mentioned, I think the most attended session will be the one that's on earlier this morning with a little, basically a couch session with Bob Baffert and Todd Pletcher just discussing their their lives here at the University of Arizona, and then continued, you know, onto the racetrack and the success they've had in training and who they've worked for, how they've gotten where they've been. So I think that starts at 8 o'clock, and then I'll go on till 9:30. I think that'll get people out of bed early and continue on with some of the other segments we have today.
We're going to talk to Pete. We're going to get a hold of Pete Fornatel, and of course Pete and Marshall and J.K. Jonathan Kinchin and Pat Cummings. The Pete not here, but the three of them, Pat and Marshall and Jonathan, going to be in your session later today.
Right, and we went out for a little dinner and drinks last night just to discuss some topics and. Where I knew Jonathan pretty well, and Pat I've known. I really got to know Marshall Graham. What a nice guy. What a good guy that he has. Got to know him last night. Not only a player, like I said the other day, one of the only few people that can get away with calling himself an economist and actually meaning it. He's a professor at Rhodes College in Memphis, teaches a class on economics, and throws in a little horse racing into the class. He's majority partner in a stable.
Ten strike
stable, and he told me. I said, "So how many horses are in your in your care? How many horses do you have?" He says, "Oh, about 80."
Yeah,
I was whoa.
Yeah.
So he has his group. He's had his best year. They've had this year. He's had 5 stake winners, over $3 million in earnings. Employs 11 different trainers. Some at fairgrounds, some are going to be at Oakland Park, parks all over the place. So, you know, another guy that's invested heavily into the game, and we're going to enter into some discussions of you know, the horse player and you know, the people that put food on everybody's table that's here at the symposium. And you know, sometimes forgotten, sometimes
sometimes
you know just don't have enough say in the game, and hopefully we can come up with a few things that informationally will help all horse players across the country, and hopefully some operators will be there, and these guys need to be sitting at the board tables of racetracks when decisions are made regarding the wagering menu.
And some tracks are better at this than others, and some organizations have a better feel for it than others. It's the ebb and flow of how certain organizations are operating, and it's funny too, because some that are bad at seemingly at certain areas might be much better at being in touch with the player, and so it's an ebb and flow. We're going to flow into a first break. We'll come right back, and I want to talk a little bit about the session that I moderated, and a few things in it. We'll see if Michael Dickinson later wants to sit in. Dickinson, at this point, it seems to me, is overselling. That was my point yesterday with him. But I thought the dirt conversation that we had with Mick Peterson, Dr. Peterson, and Glenn Kozak and Don Kuhn were, was really, I thought, edifying. One area came up that has never been discussed. We'll come back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest, we know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $125 are on them. Sign up at ExpressBet.com using promo code BYK. That's B-Y-K. And you'll get $125 when you wager $500 within your first 30 days. See what I mean? House money just for playing the races you were going to bet anyway. Check out ExpressBet.com for more information. And don't forget to sign up using promo code BYK. BYK to get that $125 bonus. You're going to love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee.
Conditions apply. Must be 18 or older and 21 in certain states. Open account with ExpressBet LLC and reside in a state where such activity is legal, void, or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line, 800-522-4700.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
The North American fall crop continues to decline, but not here in Pennsylvania. In 2019, our number of mares bred increased for the third year in a row, this time by 12.5%. Why? Our stallion roster continues to grow. We have the best incentives and bonuses. Plus, there's the stability of our racehorse development fund. Why breed anywhere else? This is Brian Sanfratello. Go to PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Up on the housetop, reindeer.
We're back at the races, back at Lowe's Ventana, and the Racetrack Industry Program Symposium on Racing, and the first of the prominent alumni. You would consider yourself a prominent alumni.
I am super prominent. I have honor. I'm a part of the, I was inducted into the Hispanic Hall of Fame here.
How about that?
That's an honor right there. So that was a pretty fun day. I remember that. So You're breathing my air right now, Steve.
That's true. That's true. And of course, so you know, it's funny because there's, I'm sure by now most people know and remember the connection, Midnight Loot with Lute Olson, and you know, so much of you know, the course of your career. Bob Baffert with us, by the way, if you don't recognize the voice. This is such a terrific place, and of course the program, you were one of the, you know, the first third of the program's alums, and what even brought you here? How did you even know there was an opportunity, and as opposed to just going out you know, onto a racetrack and starting out the way a lot of people do?
Well, I grew up an hour from here in Nogales on the border, and so all my siblings, we all went to the U of A because this is where you went. You didn't have a choice. We didn't have a choice to go anywhere.
Nobody was going to Tempe?
No, nobody. We didn't like the ASU. It was too far away anyway. So we came here, and so I promised my mother. I wanted to be a jockey. That was my – but I promised my mother that I would graduate from college. And so because you know, she was a teacher for many years and a principal, so she was really, you know, education was very important. And you know, in those days, you know, you raise your child, you make sure they graduate from college, and then you kick them loose and let them go on their way. And so I came here. This was the only school, and when I came here, I was just going to get a bachelor's degree in something, and this racing program came to life. So I thought, wow, get some pretty easy courses here. Maybe I have a shot of passing, you know. So but it was really interesting, and I met a lot of good friends. You know, I met Jimmy Bell. He has John Abell Farm, and we became really good friends. And No, but it was, you know, my best years were here in college. I mean, I had a blast. I was in a fraternity. I did everything. You know, I took full advantage. The whole thing. And so, and then my friends started graduating. I thought, I better get serious here. And then as soon as I graduated, then I just still went, I gravitated back to the horses. My father had a couple horses we had raised. And so, I was messing with them. And then finally I just became a jockey. I wanted to go back to riding. And so, I was just too big. And when I went back home, I took about a year off. So I became a substitute teacher in Nogales.
Is that right? Because
if you have a degree, you can get a substitute teacher. So I was making like $40 a day. They'd call me up at 6 in the morning. Hey, we need you. I mean, they need a substitute. There was a lot of jobs. There weren't too many people. It's basically babysitting for a day or whatever. And I did first grade, third, high school. I did it all. And then they stuck me in a junior high because this teacher had a nervous breakdown in sixth grade. So I had to take over his history course for like the rest. We're talking about in November. So I did the whole year. And
how about that?
So I had to really, I had to learn about history really quick. So I taught history and I decided I do not want to be a teacher. That is not for me. I don't have that kind of patience. And so I said, I want to get back out there. And, I gravitated right back to the horses. And then I got a job. This guy gave me a job on a little training, a little farm in Prescott, Arizona for the summer. And he decided to get a horse. And he said, maybe I'll rent a horse. And so I bought it from Los Alamitos. I bought it from Bobby Adair, the jockey. I called him up. I want to buy a horse. So we bought a horse for $17,000 to rent at Prescott Downs for this Pete Sams that lived in Phoenix. And he had a little 5-acre farm with 3 broodmare, 4 yearlings that I broke for him. And so I said, Bobby, I'll buy the horse, but you have to come ride at Prescott Downs. Prescott Downs was a little tiny, very dangerous racetrack. He said he would, and he came in and he rode the trials, and we ran second in the fraternity. And and then all of a sudden, I thought, man, this is, it's pretty cool. And we ran him in another race, and there was some trainers that got in trouble. They had some drug positives, some big trainers, and a couple of trainers, and so they had a lot of good horses, and nobody knew where to go. So one of the owners called me up and said, this guy Ray Yeh says, "Hey Bob, I got 20. They had nice horses." He goes, "Would you take these horses?" And I go, wow,
you're in business.
I'm in business. So I said I took those, and then that's when I started up. It was 1980, and then I won my first stakes win in November of 1980, and it was like snowballed into that. And then I got more owners, and next thing you know, I had started out with about, and I remember when I started out, I didn't really have a lot of cash on me, so I went to my grandmother. I said, I need to borrow $1,000 from you. And she says, for what? She says, I need to buy buckets. And I had to buy buckets.
Equipment. So sure. Equipment, you have to get tacked.
Stuff for about, 8 horses. I was going to like 10 horses, whatever it was. And she says, and I'll pay you back in 45 days. He says, none of you children have ever paid me back. I swear to you, I'm going to pay you back and I'm going to give you interest. So sure enough, I paid her back. And I'm the only one that ever paid her back.
You're the favorite grandson.
I gave her a little interest. It was my dad's mother, and so she got me going, and she'd always ask me, "Well, how much you going to make?" "Well, I think I can make." She'd always say, "Net." I said, that was a word then, And so that's how I got going, and pretty soon I hit the ground running, started winning, and then all of a sudden I got all these good horses. And see, before I only trained for my dad or a few horses, just our homebreds.
Yeah,
he was holding me back, Steve. That's why. And once I got these better horses, then I started winning, and I really got more confidence. And that's what And next thing you know, I had 40 horses in my barn. And we were rolling. I mean, we weren't running for very much money.
New Mexico and
no, just Arizona.
Just Arizona.
Yeah, we
ran just
Rodito all winter.
How about
that? The weekends all winter, and then I would.
What were the pots like?
$300, but the fraternities were like 10, 15, 20.
Sure, because everybody's paying in.
Yeah, so, if you win the fraternity, you make $1,000, $10,000 to the winner. And and that's where the excitement. But, you know, in those days, you know, it wasn't, you know, we'd win a race or whatever, but just the excitement, you know, and so, so we'd go here, and then we'd hit the fairs, little fraternities on the fair, Sonoyta, where I grew up, the Sonoyta fraternity, and then we'd go to Prescott, Arizona, and then after Prescott, we'd hit the fairs with Kingman, Arizona. We'd hit that place, and then we'd go to Holbrook, Arizona. So it was sort of fun to go to these on the weekends, and we used to run to Douglas, Arizona. It was a weird track down there. The surface was grinding from the mines, the copper mines. It was weird. I mean, like a weird surface, like almost like not gravel, but just a like a green colored.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like really weird. Like
green, like from verdigris that from the aging. If it was copper, it must have aged. It must have from the elements. It would turn green.
It was something, man. It was the weirdest track I remember. And
Douglas.
I don't think they don't run there anymore. But I'll never forget that surface. Like it was weird. And it wasn't like
that's
soft
crazy.
It was just like there were grindings of the something, you know. Yeah. But I remember that really well. And then we start back at Rialto, and you know, I broke all the records there and everything. But it was fun, you know. It was a lot of fun. And one thing about it, we never complained about the track was too hard or too fast, or it was just a glob of mud sometimes and big old dirt clods in it. We never complained about it. We never complained about any track that we went to.
Just went, you ran, you won, you lost.
We ran, and we were happy to be there.
When did the transition start to come and opportunities to go to LaSalle and hit the bigger quarter horse circuit?
Well, that was, you know, I was getting some horses from Los Alamitos because at the time, that's when there was an overabundance of horses at Los Alamitos, and it was hard to get a three-year-old maiden in at Los Alamitos. They had so many horses there. So a lot of those trainers would send their horses to me at Rialto to break their maiden so they could get a stall at Los Alamitos. So I was getting all these well-bred Dash for Cashes, all these royally bred horses that really weren't that good. So they'd send them to me, like Blaine Swanevelt would send me some.
Nice.
And these are owned by big-time owners, like the Bass Brothers from Houston and you know, really well-bred horses. And I had all Easy Jets, all these. You know, they weren't that great. But I did train for Rulon Goodman. I took over for him, and he ran the track, and he had a lot of good horses.
What, as that is happening... And we'll talk about, you know, moving the thoroughbreds as part of it. But what about training quarters and working with quarters? What did you learn and what, I mean, or is it a commonality between the breeds, between quarters and thoroughbreds and even standardbreds, I suppose, that is universal? But, you know, what kind of things did you take with you and that you still rely on that you learned from your, you know, from early horsemanship experiences?
I think a lot of it was, you know, when I first started, I used to break all my own horses. And you learn how to point a horse for a race, because in quarter horses, you want to get them, you have to run in the trials. And there's like, you know, there'll be, you know, 50, 60 horses trying to get, in Arizona, trying to get eight spots, eight horse gate. I think it's eight in Rialto, or I don't know if it was 10. I forget what it was. I think it was eight. And so, because the tracks are so narrow. And so you want to run in the trials. You want them to qualify, run fast enough, but not really just completely just.
Have something left.
Something left. And so I would train the really good ones, the ones I really knew that could really run. I could just sort of get them through there, and they'd qualify. They'd qualify sixth, seventh, eighth. You know, they could do it on their own accord. But the ones that were like, you know, I'd have them ready for their – so I could – you know, you want to have – because they pay all the way down. You know, you get a
– something.
You get a 1,000 if you run last or whatever. So but it was fun. There was a Sonoyta fraternity in Arizona near Nogales that my dad and my uncle, the one that got it going, and that was, to me, it was run on the first Saturday of May. That was and we could never win it. We tried, you know, I could never win that thing, you know. So finally, when I made my move to Los Alamitos, Brad McKenzie talked me into coming to Los Alamitos. He said, you got to come now. They had a race secretary that was really tough there. His name was Curly Smith. He was tough, because I remember going there with one horse, my dad's, and I had it there, and he gave me one stall, and I ran it, and I I ran it and it bucked in the race. It came out, it bucked. It didn't buck the jockey, but it bucked. So you had to qualify your horses. So he put me on the list. So I had to qualify it, like in the mornings, work at 350 yards. So I work at 350 yards and I go check the list. He's still on the list. I have to do it again. So I wanted to bring another horse in. So I remember going into his office and he says, Mr. Smith, and everybody was terrified of this guy. Those are the years that the race secretaries, they just are scared of him. And so I said, Mr. Smith, I noticed that my horse is still on the list and he worked today. He says, don't come in here and tell me what I need to do. He says, you know, Mr. Baffert, how many stalls did I give you? I said, one. And where did you come from? I came from Arizona. He says, usually when I give one stall to a guy from out of state, that usually means they're not going to come. But you showed up. You know, that's why I gave you one, because I put in for two, you know. And so, but, well, now that we're on the subject, I do have a second one that I want to bring. And he said, well, he said, and he stomped the, he said, well, you just come in here and say, Mr. Smith, I need another stall. And he stomped the tables. So then for some reason, I stomped the table and says, Mr. Smith, I need another stall. And he says, all right, go ahead and bring it in. I'll find a deal. So, and I brought another horse, and they're my dad's, and they never won. You know, they weren't that good of horses. But then I said, I'm not coming back to that guy. I just can't, you know, I'm not, they're not good enough, and I'm going to get beat up and take this guy. He was just, this guy was tough. He's the kind of guy that, and the guy before him, one trainer left his tack room light on, and the guy would drive through there, and he called the guy up. He says, did you leave your tack room light on? He says, oh, it was a mistake. And for a week, the guy had to unscrew the bulb and bring it to his office and come get it in the morning. I mean, that's
unbelievable.
That's what they used to do.
That's tremendous.
You know, you can't get away with that now, but.
Wow.
So then finally he was gone, and Brad calls me up. Hey, that guy's gone. You know, that guy's gone. We got a new guy. He's a good guy. He'll help you out. He'll give you whatever you need. And I had better horses, but I'll tell you what, Steve, I had, like, it was in the winter meet. I had 40 horses. So I picked my best 8 horses and I took them out there for the winter meet just for a couple months just to try it out. If it worked, then I'd stay. If it not, and I'll never forget the first night I had my 3 best horses in. The first one runs fourth. The second one ran fourth. And my best filly, she's in the feature, 5 o'clock rush. She's in the one hole. And I told Brad, I said, Brad, and he's like, don't worry. Just, you know, Brad was my cheerleader. Said, don't worry. Come on. He said, if this filly doesn't win, I'm out of here. I can't make it. I'm gone. I'm going to just pack my stuff. And I'll just rather be the big fish in the little pond, you know. And damn if that filly didn't win. She wins the race by a head. And that was it. That's all I needed. I needed that, you know, that little push. And then I went back to California, and I just told everybody, you know what, I'm sorry, but you guys going to need a trainer for your other horses here. I'm getting out. But what happened, see, Relito had closed. So we didn't have a lot of racing. So during the winter for a couple of years, I had to train at Turf Paradise outside. I had to rent a barn and then walk my horses like about almost like a half a mile to the track to get them ready for Prescott for the fair. So that wasn't going to work out. So I went to Los Alamitos and I just picked up. And Brad McKenzie really helped me. He introduced me to a lot of people and started picking up horses from other people I didn't know. And I mean, he was really so instrumental in that. And not only that, he was just a good friend anyway, but just so instrumental. And he was my biggest cheerleader.
The filly's name again? 5 o'clock?
5 o'clock rush.
5 o'clock rush. That's
and
a good name.
You know
name.
What? When I tried the Thoroughbreds, the last horse, we had like a Breeders' Cup type race at Los Alamitos already, and I just won.
Champion of Champions or?
No, it's like they had this Breeders' Cup. They tried the Breeders' Cup, their own little Breeders' Cup. And so it was Cal Cup. I'd won 4 stakes on Cal Cup race day. And I went down and I had a bunch in that night. And the last race of the night was this little 2-year-old stake race. And it was 8 o'clock rush was in there. It was 5 o'clock rush's baby. And he won. And I quit that night.
And that was the end
that
of the.
That was the end of
so
it.
So you started with 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock rush got you going, and ended with 8 o'clock.
And that was my last one.
That's tremendous.
So I think really everything happened for a reason, and so I was done and walked away. I just left all my tack there, bought all new tack, and gave it to my friends. I had Laura Pinelli, who was my assistant. She got most of them. Carlos Lopez, he's a trainer down there. I gave him the horses, and Jaime Gomez was just a bloodstock agent there, and he took a lot of my equipment. He started out, so and that's
Who was the first? Who was the first owner to express confidence and give you a thoroughbred?
Well, Hal Earnhardt, I was training quarter horse for him, and he's been my longest supporter. I've had him since 1983. And he bought a thoroughbred, and then Mike Pegram, they were friends through his father Tex, and they bought a quarter horse together. And that's how I met Mike.
Okay.
For a year, and then Mike says, "What?" And he said, "You know what? Why don't you try thoroughbreds?" And he said, "Well, I don't know. That's I'd have to learn." And so I said, "Well, if you give me a year, let me claim a few, and then we'll do it." And
play
he said,
around.
Sure, go ahead. Let me get because I still had my quarter horses. So it took me a couple of years just to get my footing, and it was all trial and error. And but they were really patient, and when Mike was a lot of fun. I remember he took me to my first Super Bowl. I was 49ers down in Miami. I played Cincinnati.
I was going to say the Bengals. That was a good game.
The catch. I was there.
That was a good game.
I was there sitting in the end zone there, and so it just really took me to places I've never been, with Mike, like I've never flown first class or done anything like that. I mean, it was, with Mike, it was just first class. So we hit it off, and I asked him one time, we're getting in the elevator. I said, "No, Mike, why did you pick me? Why would you?" He said, "Let me tell you something. In this business, you lose more than you win, and you're a lot more fun to be with when we lose." I'll never forget when he said that, So
and that's that's an insight that should be etched somewhere, because Tommy Kelly said, when you hire as an owner, when you hire a trainer, when you pick a trainer, you're buying a friend, and so make sure it's somebody that you want to you have a rapport with, and that you have an energy with, and you have fun with. Because you, as Pegram says, you lose more than you win.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been that way. I mean, I've had really, now I have really good chemistry with certain people. Some guys, I just knew from the beginning, it's probably not, this is not going to jive. It's not my, and a lot of people can be intimidated by me, and they shouldn't, because I'm really sort of a laid back kind of guy, And so then when they get to know me, they go, you're not at all like, people say you are and all that. And so I really don't, once people get to know me, I'm like, I used to like to joke around. A lot of people didn't like my humor. But the reason I do that is just you'll go crazy if you don't. This game, if you let it, will make you bitter. So you have to keep digging your way out of it. So there's going to be, I keep telling my wife that.
Well put.
She'll get really down on everything. I said, honey. It's still the greatest sport. It's fun. I've met the best. I've made a lot of friends. You meet really interesting people. I've met presidents. I've met, all these kings and sheiks and all these people and a few movie stars. And, it's sort of like.
Yeah, it's glamorous.
It's a very glamorous. But in the quarter horse, you don't have that. So the quarter horse. You just don't have
a lot of belt buckles, a lot of hats.
A lot of belt buckles and hats, and I'll tell you what, he's ready, Bob. So it's one of those things where, and I look back, and I remember I wanted to win the All-American Futurity, and I went back, and I had a horse in it, but I couldn't, I was just getting the thoroughbred business, and his name was Ed Grimley. So I sent it to a trainer, and they said, we're going to just split it, and his name is Sleepy Galbraith, and some really nice guy, just laid back.
That's why they called him Sleepy.
He looks like Sleepy from the Seven Doors. He's got that face on him, Nice guy. And so we went over there, and Mike Pegram. We got a little jet. We flew over there. It was about eight of us. My brother Bill went. It was just, we had a blast, you know. And so, and Mike Pegram, he's in the paddock. He says, man, he says, I've never seen a paddock where whoever wins this race is going to change their life because they're going to get $1 million. It's just, you know,
yeah.
I'll never forget. He
yeah.
said that. He says, yeah, because the guy that I trained for, he said, man, if I win this race, I'm going to buy myself a dairy down in Roswell, New Mexico. He had a dairy in Phoenix. And I'm doing, you know, all these plans. And we got beat ahead. We got caught right at the wire. But you know what? I didn't feel that excitement because I'd already been in the thoroughbred, and I was training Indian Charlie's mother at the time. I'd won a little steak with her. So I got a flavor of
what
the big
be.
Time.
What could happen. Yeah.
You know, and so like, wow, this is, you know, it's like, and after that, I said, I can't believe I used to give the quarter horse jockeys instructions. I mean, just hold on, dude. You
know? Don't fall off.
Yeah.
What? You go back to the transition and to starting to get your hands on thoroughbreds, and what did you find that you ended up needing to learn, and what surprised you about thoroughbreds that you didn't expect?
Well, I mean, they have to train basically every day. Where a quarter horse, once you get them fit, you don't have to do too much.
It's easy to keep them fit.
You walk them, you gallop them maybe every other day, a little easy, keep them sharp, keep them sound. Got to keep them really sound. Quarter horses, you have to keep them very, very sound, because if they're not, if something's bugging them, they won't break. And if they don't break,
it's over.
It's over. It's over. So you have to really keep them really healthy and very sound. Where a thoroughbred, you know, you have to track them every day, but then there's you have to handicap. You have to handicap your horse distances. You know, that was the hardest part. Is he a sprinter? Does he want to go long? Does he want to do this and that? And so, you know, it took me, and I'm still learning. I'm still learning to this day. And but one of these days I'm going to figure it out completely, but I'm not there yet. But
seems like you're pretty close.
It's one of those things where it was just trial and error. I never worked for anybody.
Yeah.
If I could have gone to work for somebody, it would have jump-started my so I just started on my own, and I was just listening to people.
But it may have also the flip side of that is you basically – were a blank slate, as opposed to having somebody whose angle on horses colors your approach and stamps your approach. You basically were a blank slate, and you just started to add the information. How long did it take you to begin to understand the physical differences, you know, in terms of stride, length of body, the way a thoroughbred grows and changes as they age?
Well, I mean, to me, I think what I brought into it is I had a lot of good luck buying my own quarter horses, and so I went to the sales. I remember going to the Keeneland sale the first time. I was like, wow. Man, I saw the beautiful ones, and I see a pretty one, you know, and I follow them up there, and I had a budget, $20,000.
For how many?
For one.
Okay, for one.
For
all
one.
Right.
I'd go up there. That thing would bring $300,000-$400,000. This is crazy. These people are crazy. What are they thinking about, you know? So then I go back. You know, for $20,000, I could get a great quarter horse. So, this went on for 3 days. Just, I was getting up.
So, book one, book two?
Book two. Finally, I think we got to about book three, and I see this big, gray, long-bodied, beautiful, stout horse. And I remember this. There was a guy that used to be in the quarter horse. He was managing the farm there, and he looks at me and says, hey, Baffert, those aren't the type you want. I said, dude, I'm sticking with what I like.
Yeah.
And before that, I went to Claiborne Farms, and I wanted to look at all the stallions to see, get an idea. I saw Secretariat. I wanted to see him, and he was this big shoulder, his neck, big deep heart girded, but he didn't have much of a hind end. He was really post legged.
Yeah.
And I really wasn't like, wow, you know, it's not really
not
my
what you
type.
Expected.
No. And then I saw Spectacular Bid. He's a, you know, not great, nice looking, but light, really light bone. You know, beautiful conformation, long neck, but light bone. Like, and then I liked Nijinsky the second. I didn't like him at all. He was too thoroughbred for me, you know. That's what I used to say, you know, too light. And then I saw Mr. Prospector look pretty good, but he was a little bit, you know, upright. His shoulder was a little straight or something. I remember he was all right. But the horse they brought out that I love was Danzig.
Hmm.
When they brought him out, I go, that's me right there. So that's what I that I stuck to. So all of a sudden I see this gray horse, and I said, man, he's beautiful. I follow him up there, and I have this guy with me, this quarter horse owner. And we're sitting there, and we start bidding. And we get up to 20, and then somebody hits him at 21. I said, come on, dude, you got to hit him. No, 20, that's all I'll go. I said, come on, hit him at 21. He said, hit 22. And he says, you know what? I said, if you love him so much, you have a lot of big other owners. Why don't you buy him for them? So when he said that, he sort of got me, like, mad. You know?
Yeah.
So I hit him. All right, so I hit him again, 25, 26, probably 29. So I was like, I hit him at 30. And when I hit him at 30, Steve, I said, please, somebody hit him. Please.
You didn't want it at that point?
I'm going over. I don't know. Who am I going to sell this horse to? I'm nervous. I'm scared. Finally, 30, sold right there. And I go, oh, man. They brought the pad over. You got to fill it out. I fill that thing out, put my address, name of the firstborn, everything. I filled out the whole thing. And I'm shaking. I'm shaking. I write my name. I get up right away. I got to go get a better look at this horse. I'm walking out. I'm going by there, and I see that same guy's back there. He says, Baffert, don't tell me you bought that horse. I said, yep, I got him. He said, so I go down there, and I'm looking at him, and there was a guy a quarter horse trainer from Texas that was there waiting at the barn. And I'm running to him. I said, hey, what are you doing here? I'm waiting to see they bought this horse back, and I'm going to, I'm going to offer him something. So I go out there and say, hey, can I see a gray horse out here, please, that just sold? He said, oh, you're looking at him too? I says, I just bought him. He says, wow. He said, it was Ben Walden that I bought him from. And he goes, he told me he was going to bring $60,000, so I didn't bid on him. Well, I bought him for $30,000, and I tell you what, I don't have a buyer for him, but if you give me $1,000, I'll give you the ticket, I told him. And he says, nah, it's okay. So then I've got it now. Then all of a sudden I start getting paged. Bob Baffert, please come to the main office. So I go up there and I go, excuse me, I just got paged. Like, sir, you just purchased a horse and you don't have credit here. Well, I'm here. My name is Bob Baffert. I'm a big quarter horse trainer. I started giving him all this deal. He says, we don't care. We need a call. Luckily, I took a check with me. I always had to carry a check with me. So I'll write you a check right now. He says, well, sir, we have to call your bank, make sure this check is. I barely had enough money to cover that check.
That's unbelievable.
I had like $32,000.
That's great.
And they put a stop on that. They grabbed that money right there. So I said, oh, this is nice. And then I call Hal Earnhardt, and I made a mistake. He didn't answer, and I talked to his wife. I said, I bought this horse for $30,000. I should have just waited. So by the time I called him back, that's with the payphone. You had to get on the payphone. And so then I called back. He says, he tells me later, finally, I call him back. He says, you know what? It's just too much. I can't do it and all this stuff. Because, if I would have just talked to him myself, I could have.
Yeah, she already. The fix was it.
The fix was in. I made a big mistake. So I'm coming back, and Artie Hubbard, he'd given me a ride in his plane from Los Alamitos, and he was going back. So I says, when I go back, I'll go back with you. I was on a super. This is a profit deal for me. I was on a super low budget. So he says, and he goes. He goes, hey, Baffert, did you buy anything? I said, matter of fact, I didn't. I don't have an owner. I said, you want to take half? I'll keep half of it. I already paid for him. I said, I had to pay for him right away, but I took all my savings out of that thing. And so, and he looks at the pedigree and he brings
what out. What was the pedigree?
He was by Sloopy out of a Hatchetman mare. And so, but what's funny? I told Jimmy Bell after I bought him, I went to John Bell Farm. I hadn't seen Jimmy Bell in 15 years.
Since
the U of A.
Yeah.
So I said, you buy anything? Yes. Matter of fact, I did. And I opened up my wallet and I had the page folded up in my wallet. I bought this horse right here. He says, wow. It's just Sloopy. He says, we stand Sloopy. He's right here. Really? I said, and he wasn't doing that well, Uh-huh. No kidding. I go, wow. And what kind of mare? He says, I didn't even notice the pedigree. I didn't even look. The pedigree didn't mean nothing.
It was the body, the physical.
It's a hatchet man. When we were going to school, we got CB radios. Remember when the CB radios were out?
Sure.
Well, I went to his house, and he had a blood horse on his table, and there was a horse called Hatchet Man was on the cover. I said, you know what? That's going to be my CB handle, Hatchet Man. Oh. And to this day, Jimmy Bill calls me Hatchet. Hey, Hatchet, what's going on?
That's never great.
So I go, he's out of a Hatchet Man mirror. I just, and Sloopy's here. This horse has to be a runner. I'm telling you, I believe in that stuff. And sure enough, it was 30 slews. Wins a Breeders' Cup Sprint.
Unbelievable.
Got him home. I sent him right to Los Alamitos. I van him to Los Alamitos. And I cut him up with my quarter horse owners, and I kept a piece. And Mike Pegram took a piece, and we win the Breeders' Cup Sprint with him.
That's unbelievable.
Unbelievable. So what a, and I yelled at him immediately, you know, so. What a horse, though. But I you know what? He taught me a lot. I mean, he was a really good horse. And I wasn't really ready for a horse like that. And I almost ruined him. He, you know, I was trying to put him on the Derby trail there and all that stuff. And but he was a really good sprinter. Big, beautiful horse.
And you know, you say that you weren't ready, quote unquote. And there is a little bit of a lag before, you know, you start to really send out, you know, a sequence of, you know, of top horses, classic horses, and every other kind of stake horse. Lewis.
But I was still like in the year before that, I went to the Breeders' Cup. I took Soviet Sojourn. It was Indian Charlie's.
Oh, yeah.
Churchill. And she was tailing off on me, and I didn't know what I was. You know what? I look back, and I'll never forget. I went to the Churchill Downs. It must have been like, it was so cold. It was like 40 degrees or whatever.
Yeah, it was a terrible, terrible day.
It was cold. I'm walking up there, and I have a Oxford shirt on, and it's so cold. And I had a sport coat, no overcoat, nothing. I didn't, you know, I wasn't. And I'm walking up there, and I'm freezing. I'm walking up. It was, you know, just me and my groom, and I'm walking up there, and I'm, and I'll never forget, my nipples were so hard, and they were rubbing against his super hard start shirt. And I'm telling you, that's all I could think about. And I kept grabbing myself like, I mean, they were just raw by the time I got up there. And I got my ass kicked, and it was just terrible. But you know what? I saw Arazi.
Arazi. Arazi.
His race was unbelievable.
Yeah, it was.
I'll never forget that. That was one of the most
unforgettable
classic performances I've ever seen. And I learned a lot from that. And I remember I was at Stain there, and I was across, and I saw Woody Stevens was at a little – I saw him across at this table having dinner, and he was getting – he was pretty old then. And he had an oxygen tank. He had it on his – and I wanted to walk up and introduce myself to him. But I was too scared. I was too intimidated to go up there and introduce myself. Like, hey, I'm a new trainer. I'm trying to get into business. But I wish I would have gone up there and talked to him, because he was just, you know, I really enjoyed watching. He was, you know, he brought a lot to the sport. I loved listening to all his little one-liners, you know, and stuff. But, you know, I was sort of shy and intimidated to walk up to him and say, hey, I just want to meet you. And didn't do it.
Well, from there, though, the tables have turned, as you suggest. You know, some people, they see you and they're intimidated, and they shouldn't be either.
Yeah, and so when people, I've had young trainers come up, hey, I'm starting out. And I remember that. I said, well, yeah, well, good luck to you. Any words of wisdom? I said, yeah, you better be ready to work 7 days a week and just live it and breathe it. That's all. If you want to be successful, you got to live it and breathe it, because not only you're responsible for all those horses, but you're responsible for a lot of employees, families that count on you. That's a lot of pressure. Like this winter, when we were having problems out there at Santa Anita,
yeah,
that was one of the big things that you know, if this doesn't work out, I got a lot of families that are counting on me, and you know, they just can't pick up and all go or whatever. And they've been with me for, you know, 20 years and seen all their kids grow up. So there's a lot of extra pressure that, you know, that people don't know about, you know, but it's been very, you know, I'm so lucky that it worked out, you know, and I'm glad that my grandmother lent me that $1,000. I don't know what would have happened if she didn't give me the money, but it was, you know, things happen for a reason.
It's one of the, you know, it's one of the things about the game that, you know, there's a certain degree of luck that that just is out there to be captured. And I suppose some of it, you know, some of it is just knowing, just being relaxed. And as you've discussed before, I mean, just adjusting. I mean, how you always talk about making decisions with horses during the run up on the classic trail and just making those decisions on feel.
Well, I remember when I was like 16, Wayne Lucas comes into Sonoyta with these shiny trailers and these fancy horses to run in the trials. And I went up to the fence and go, and everybody was saying, that's Wayne Lucas, man. That's that guy that's like, and I wanted to go up and introduce myself. I was scared to death of Wayne. I was like, that's him. And I got a close look and I'm watching him. And man, he's a great horseman and horse trainer. He's a great horseman, but he was a good showman and he knew how to, for the better, he knew how to promote the sport. He really, and when he came into the quarter horse business, he changed Los Alamitos quarter horse. I mean, the barns, all of a sudden, he had the most beautiful barns.
The flowers.
We'd go in there and stuff. He'd rake at the herringbone. Every time I see a herringbone rake job, that's Wayne Lucas. And people that try to go toe-to-toe with him, they went broke. They couldn't stay up because he kept winning. And then when he came to the thoroughbreds, he changed it all. And, you know, and during the process, he sort of rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And they, you know, and so, you know, the thing about Wayne, he was never really, when you come from the quarter horse and just jumped in there, he was really totally never accepted fully when you come for the hard boots. And because he didn't come up from, you know, they think a lot of the trainers are, you know, come in like, you know, the typical trainer is supposed to look like Leroy Jolly.
There you go.
You know, the old, I love Leroy. I got to know him his last few years. I just love, and you know what? I told Leroy when I saw him, I said, when I see you, Leroy, I'm intimidated. Because to me, Leroy was above me. Because I watched him, you know, I think he was a great trainer and all these guys. And I see him, just like Lasbrera and those guys. Yeah. I would never consider myself at their level. To me, they're still above me. You know what I mean? So when you see these guys when you're growing up on television.
Yeah.
You know, and like, and Laz, I used to pick their brain, these older guys.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I tell you what's helped me, and I tell my kids, is you got to be very curious in life.
Absolutely.
And you have to ask questions. Are we running a little long?
They're calling for you.
They're calling for me?
Yeah.
All right, Steve.
But I got you warmed up.
I saw Todd Pletcher showed up. They told me he wouldn't show up.
Why not?
Showed up. Actually, Todd actually graduated in 4 years. It took me 6. All right.
Enjoy it.
Thank you.
This was fabulous. Thank you.
All right.
As always, unbelievable. Bob Baffert, let's take a break. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to dig into everybody's time with the kids. And let's take a break. Hammer's coming right back. And we're going to get some kids on. And we're going to get Sid Fernando in for a visit. And he's going to explain about, you know, how to get into the pedigree side. If you're a young person and you want to work for a farm, you want to work on the sales end, you want to work for a consigner, Sid will talk about that and how, you know, we know how the horse side works and probably a lot of the business side, you know, track operators and so forth. But that's an area. And when we were here last year, you know, there was, I think in all the time we've been coming, there's only been one of the students that had expressed a bloodstock interest. Now I've been introduced to two or three more, and so we'll get Sid in for that too. A lot of fun. how about that story? And delivered perfectly from Baffert about 30 slews, because everybody was saying, did the horse become anything? Who's the horse? And 30 slews. That was great. Back after this to Symposium.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
At the track or on the go, ExpressBet is your way to play the races. ExpressBet provides legal and secure online and mobile betting on more than 300 of the world's top tracks and all the big events. And when you sign up for an ExpressBet account today with promo code BYK, that's B-Y-K, you'll receive a $125 bonus. Once you've signed up, you can take your wagering experience to the next level with XB Rewards, ExpressBet's industry-leading loyalty program. Earn points for every bet you make and cash them in on everything from wagering credits to exclusive racetrack experiences. So what are you waiting for? Sign up for ExpressBet today using promo code BYK. That's B-Y-K to get your $125 bonus. Conditions apply. Must be 18 or older and 21 in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet LLC and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void where prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
145 over 92.
180 over 111.
182 over 100. And I had a heart attack and a cardiac arrest. And then a stroke.
Your blood pressure numbers could change your life.
A lot of people don't understand, including myself, I didn't, now I do, the impact of having a stroke.
My memory is shot.
When I woke up, I couldn't speak.
If I would have followed a treatment plan, I would not be in this situation.
It's a tough journey.
Lowering your high blood pressure could save you from a heart attack or stroke. If you've stopped your treatment plan, restart it, or talk to your doctor about creating one that works better for you. Start taking the right steps at manageyourbp.org.
It's a new life, but I'm going to make it better. I'm coming back. Ask your doctor. Check your blood pressure.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
I know you mistletoe, I want to get to know you. This Christmas, and as we trim the tree, how much fun it's going to be today.
We're back. It was just a buzz of activity here because Todd Pletcher arrived as we were wrapping up with Baffert. Frankly, I got the sense that he would have stayed the rest of the show had there not been a specific assignment for him at the top of the hour, but. I don't know if he's perfected these stories or if he just delivers them with a certain aplomb, but he just told his story of the first horse he bought at Keeneland with 30 slews, which was just wildly entertaining.
Well, Bob is, when you get to know Bob and he's comfortable around you, he's got 100 of those stories.
Yeah.
And you know, he doesn't usually tell this. You know, some guys have two stories and they tell the same two stories wherever they go. He's got 100 stories and you might hear the same one twice. And it's pretty good. And And when he come walking down the hall, he's with his brother Bill, who lives in Tucson here. And Bob just told me that the other day. And I said, man. And I said, Bill, I didn't know you lived here. And he goes, thank God you didn't. He'd be knocking on my door every day. And I said, yeah, you're probably right. But Bill's the same way. He's over there telling stories and stories about those guys growing up and doing things. So, you know, very gracious. And they said, Todd came here a little bit ago, 10, 15 minutes ago, talking over there. And I told some of the students earlier when they said, do you know Bob Baffert? Do you know Todd Pletcher? Can you introduce us? I said, yeah, just show up in the morning. Believe me, they're fine. They used to be you. They get it. So group of 7, 8, 9 kids are over here. And when Bob got off and Todd was here, then, you know, they're chit-chatting over there a little bit. And, you know, some of them a little starstruck. But, just I say, hey, these guys started in school just like you did. And, you know, you can move right up the ladder. But so gracious enough not just to be here to do the little interview with you, but now they're on stage there doing a little Oprah couch session, just chit-chatting just like they were with you. So, and like I say, when you come to these things, it's open to the public. You could be sitting there in the audience and listen to it. So, you know, very, very entertaining. It's not all business here. So I like to show some of the lighter side of the business and show that these guys, yeah, they go to work every day. They train a lot of horses. They deal with a lot of different people, but they're just regular guys. And that's what you're going to see. That's what the people are going to see in the room in there.
He told a racing secretary story from Los Al that I've never heard. Curly Smith?
He used to be, from what I understand, the toughest racing secretary on record, bar none, anywhere. Knew every horse on the grounds, knew everything about everybody.
He said, he told the story. The guy left the light on in the tack room, and apparently Smith would go around the barns every night. He made the trainer unscrew the light bulb out of the tack room and bring it to his office every afternoon, and then come pick it up the next day for a week.
I've heard stories. My good friend Bruce Jackson, who trained quarter horses over there before, of In Excess fame, before he transferred over to the Thoroughbred game, he used to tell me stories about Curly Smith and still does. And I didn't believe him at first, and then I'd start getting a little few backup stories around the corner. But I can believe that, right? In other words, hey, bud, you're not wasting electricity. Unless you need that bulb, you leave it with me. And if I didn't know the background, I'd say, BSing. But, yeah.
Oh, my God. It made me laugh.
But there's stories about this guy. You know, if you brought a horse in, if you had 9 stalls and you brought that 10th horse in, he knew it, and he would literally put you on the horse and tell you to ride it out the gate. I mean, I've heard all kinds of stories about Curly Smith. Never met the guy, but quite a legend in quarter horse history down there at Los Alamitos.
Now, and you know, every time Baffert brings up Brad McKenzie, he's as tender as anybody. You know, when his dad talks about his dad, talks about the chief. And reverential about, you know, the icons of the training game. And
absolutely. Yeah. He did. And as I was talking to Bill was telling some stories about, you know, not just like growing up, but recently. And the name Brad McKenzie was sprinkled throughout stories about, oh, Brad did this when Brad was here. So these guys are, you know, as tight as you can ever get. So I know Bob is really, really happy that they picked the right horse. They picked a good horse, a true horse, you know, a champion type of horse to name after Brad, and to see him go out and perform and do great. So, he lost a good buddy. But what else can you say?
Exactly. Well, it got very quiet here because everybody's in listening to Bob and Todd. So the kids are in there, so we can't do anything with the kids right this minute.
We've got one over in the wings over here in the blue room. Right over here, Matthew.